KSS 1100 AM Berlin, W252 DR Oshkosh, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is a special report from ABC News, Hurricane Milton. I'm Mike Dubusky. Landfall for Hurricane Milton in Siesta Key, Florida. The Category 3 storm brings 120-mile-per-hour winds, tornadoes, and up to 12 feet of storm surge in some areas. The most dangerous surge is expected in Sarasota, where we find ABC's Victor Akendo.
Parts of Sarasota already flooded. Calvin Bryant has lived in Sarasota since 1957, choosing not to evacuate.
So when your family, your kids, and grandchildren told you to please leave, what was your response?
I'm not going nowhere.
Many families heeding the warnings, jamming highways for days. 1,900 gas stations, about a quarter of all stations statewide, running out of fuel. Florida's governor, Ron DeSantis, urging the entire state to stay on alert.
Officials already reporting more than 100 homes have been destroyed and more than 800,000 people are without power. This is ABC News.
I'm Lisa Hale with WISS News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anytime at the WISS website at wiss.fm.
Civic Media News, I'm Derek Tritz. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Wisconsin wildlife officials are warning about a disease fatal to deer, commonly known as EHD. The Department of Natural Resources has confirmed cases in deer from Chippewa, Jackson, and Waukesha counties. EHD is spread by insects that bite. Humans can't get it. Anyone who sees a sick or dead deer is urged to contact the DNR. Wisconsin crews are standing by to help Florida recover from Hurricane Milton. Stuart J. Waddles reports.
Power crews from Cedarburg, Oconomowoc, and Hartford are preparing to assist with recovery efforts. We Energies is also sending a team of over 24 workers down to help restore power and mitigate the impact of the hurricane. To find out how you can help, visit civicmedia.us/help. I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
And that's what you need to know. I'm Derek Tritz, and this is Civic Media News.
The Dom Salvia Show.
Ann Egan Walkoff from Wisconsin Native Vote.
20 years ago, I moved to a suburb of Milwaukee. I went to register, and the woman was like, "You're Indian? Indians don't vote. You can't vote."
What?
So when I'm talking to a group of Native Americans, did I tell them that story? And they're like, "What?" And that gets their dander up. And I'm going to go
yeah,
vote for sure.
Absolutely.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, home for Matt and Air on Air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to talk about. Again, want to start today's program off with much appreciation, much thanks for the folks who have reached out and wished our family well. As you know, my wife was involved in a motorcycle accident just about a month ago now. And some positive news, moving from the intensive care ward to something called an LTAC, a long-term acute care facility. So the question of survival, whether she will live or die, that's off the table. Now it's how much she's going to recover. We'll see in the coming weeks and months how much of her brain trauma will heal, how much will come back, and all good stuff, all very, very positive. We're grateful, and thank you for all the people who have sent thoughts and prayers and best wishes and good vibes and all of that stuff. So I want to thank everyone and give a little quick update as well. Now here's some weird stuff. The violence speak is rising. Trump hinting at violence against people who support Kamala Harris at a recent rally. You know, it's one of these weird things. We're in a time where political leaders, seem to think that it's okay to say at a rally that it's dangerous, very dangerous, for Kamala Harris voters to identify themselves because they'll get hurt. He literally said this. The sick guy who says he wants to be a dictator for a day and has made these kind of overtures of retribution, of payback, of using the office to, well, settle some scores. And does that mean that his political rivals, I know he's tweeted or posted on social media pictures of Nancy Pelosi or Hillary or Kamala Harris in orange jumpsuits. We've seen that. But this is a little bit further. You know, the voters, you voters, we might be coming for you. We might be paying attention to you. And it's not just Trump. It's the right-wingosphere, if you will. Elon Musk, for instance. Elon was doing some kind of interview with Schmucker Carlson. And here's what Elon had to say.
Which is like nobody's even bothering to try to kill Kamala because it's pointless. What do you achieve? Nothing.
No, it's totally
just
right.
Another puppet.
Exactly. That's.
It's no point in
killing. It's deep and true, though.
Nobody's trying to kill Joe Biden.
It's in,
it would be pointless.
Totally.
And you know, the thing is, I look at Tucker's face, and I got to tell you, he doesn't look comfortable. Doesn't look comfortable with that at all. But he knows the world he's in. He knows this sells. You know, nobody's trying to bother to kill Kamala. Nobody's bothered to try and kill Joe Biden. You know, they're just trying to kill Donald Trump. But do you know who's trying to kill Donald Trump? Am I the only one who's noticed that these are people who supported Donald Trump? These aren't wild lefties. And look, thank goodness no one's tried to kill Kamala Harris or Joe Biden. And I don't want anyone to try and kill Donald Trump. We beat them at the ballot box. That's the America that I grew up in. But to have political leaders, this used to be a line nobody crossed because leaders of the past, real leaders, true people who have the best interest of the country at heart, understand once you start down this path, it gets ugly really quickly. And this idea that we're going to threaten people who support the other side. Look, I may think you're ridiculous. I may think you're brain dead. I may think the Chinese red in the MAGA hats is doing something to your brain. I don't wish ill, harm. I'm certainly not going to come for you. But, you know, there used to be a moment in our history where this wasn't who we were. Now, is Elon threatening? No, I don't think he's making a direct threat. But I think casually joking about it. About killing a president is a line that we've never crossed, that we at least never used to cross. So I guess is this the sign of the times? Because again, I go back to once we continue to normalize this kind of rhetoric, and I know it's free speech, Rick, free speech. But once we normalize this kind of rhetoric, it only has to get worse. It can only go one way. And that is worse. That is more coarse, more harsh, more violent. And I don't see how that's good. I don't see how that's good for you, me, our democracy, humanity. Because again, what we're not hearing from the Trump campaign at all is what policy he's going to pursue to make your life better. What are they going to do to make your life better? Now, if you think, you know, locking Hillary up or going after Kamala Harris or coming after me, if you think that's somehow going to make your life better, then, well, by all means, you go and you vote for Donald Trump and the Republicans. But if you need, you know, better jobs, if you need infrastructural improvements, if you need better opportunities for education, you need safer workplaces, the plethora of things that are much more important than who we hate. If that's where you're at, I don't see this election as very difficult to figure out. Seems to me kind of a no-brainer. But this is where we are. Want to hear your thoughts. Is this too much or is it, hey, Rick, we live in a country with free speech. Rick at the RickSmithShow.com. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I don't know if you've been noticing, but the level of bull, you know what, seems to be increasing. If you've been watching the Trump rallies, if you've been watching J.D. Vance, you've been watching the Republican leadership as a whole, you need deep boots and a high, high waders, because it's getting thick. And you go, well, politicians have always lied. Yeah, but this seems a little different. And I know this is the party of alternative facts and alternative reality. I get that. But this time feels even more. And if you watch the debate with J.D. Vance, you kind of go, it's worse. And I look at the piece by David Corn over at Mother Jones. His headline, Trump is running a disinformation campaign, not a political campaign. He says he's not just lying, he's creating an alternative reality. And my friend Will Bunch has got a new piece out titled The Only Freedom That Matters to Today's Republicans is the Right to Lie. And that seems right on board. That's why I've asked our good friend Will Bunch to come talk to us. Will's a national columnist over at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Will, thanks for making time for us.
Hey, Rick. Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So, look, we've always said Trump's been full of it. He's always lied. We've always got this kind of misinformation, alternative reality, alternative facts. This is old news, but I just get the feeling like this is it. It's all they got.
Yeah, I mean, something has changed. I think, Trump has always been a liar. And we've had some kind of political lying as long as we've had politicians. LBJ and the credibility gap, or however far back you want to go, right? But something is really different about this, because eight years ago Trump would say things like, I'm the least racist person you've ever met. Or he'd say, or 4 years ago, we've had the best economy under my presidency, and things that are pretty easily disprovable, but they were just kind of random lying statements, And what we've really seen the last couple of months is kind of alarming is, like David Corn said, this not even lying. I mean, it's the difference between a lie that's based on something that's sort of factual, which is how most lying goes down, or something that's just a complete fiction.
Just made up out of whole cloth.
From the start. Yeah, and,
my grandfather used to say, there's some people would lie when the truth would be better. That's this.
Yeah, I mean, the two big fictions, the two big alternate realities, or I guess it's two, maybe there's more right now, but... It started with this whole thing over the immigrants in Springfield, Ohio, the Haitian immigrants, whether it was eating pets, stealing geese, causing murders, causing spreading communicable diseases, all of it just totally made up.
They're made for crime. Crime is in their DNA, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and J.D. Vance with this semi-admission that we have to, quote, create stories, unquote, to get the media to cover the things we want to talk about. It's like, no, it's like, you don't want, you know, it's like, you don't want the media talking about, you know, we've got this, these two hurricanes, you know, they don't want the media talking about climate change and fossil fuels and its responsibility. You know, we've got, you know, the economy, the unemployment rate being low. Well, they don't want you talking about those things. So they're just going to create something that's, you know, like any novelist, right? You're trying to create a story that's going to titillate people's imaginations and really speak to the things that really drive them, right? You know, and so it's, we're going to make up stories about immigrants or, you know, whatever's going wrong in your life. It's immigrants are taking your job. They're, you know, they're the reason your rent is so high. They're, you know, and if that's not good enough, then they're stealing your pets, you know. And, you know, speaking of these hurricanes, I mean, climate change is a horrible issue for Republicans, right? You know, they've got Project 2025. They want to gut the EPA. They want to break up, you know, NOAA, the main agency that does weather predicting. You know, they want to cut all sorts of programs and gut FEMA as well, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. They don't want you talking about that. Right. So instead, they've made up this, again, complete fiction that a pool of money that was supposed to go to, you know, presumably, I guess, American or white American or whatever, hurricane victims, you know, was instead given to these immigrants, you know, that it was stolen from you. And I mean, first of all, the government has enough money to deal with hurricanes, number one. And two, yeah, there's a program to help migrants. It's funded totally separately, funded by Congress. You know, or they'll just say the government's doing nothing about Hurricane Helene.
Well, even worse than that, though, you know, Will, you know, I was watching social media, you know, in the days after the hurricane, and there are people who are sitting on the side of the road going, you know, we're running from FEMA because, you know, they're going to confiscate our stuff and put us into camps, and they're
blocking relief flights that they were doing.
Right. And
I mean, things that just make absolutely no sense unless you had some like horrible fascist government that was trying to kill its own citizens, which thankfully we don't have now, or at least we don't have yet.
The reason I bring this up is, you know, here's this person, you know, talking about, you know, FEMA's coming for them from the security of the side of the road. And never once did this person look over their shoulder to see if someone was coming. So for me, I'm going, if you're really on the run, are you out in broad daylight? Are you sitting on the side of the road, you know, in your vehicle, you know, with the air conditioning on, you know, recording a long screed on your video, on your phone that can be traced? I mean, if you're really in that world, you know, or is it just total and complete BS? And look, you know,
they want to crush reality. Because they want you to be in this state where you're going to believe whatever Trump, you know, tells them.
No, and this is where I wanted to go with this, because look, I'm a free speech guy. I think you should have the right to say what's on your mind. I think you should have the right to argue your point of view, especially between you and your government, because that's what free speech is. Yeah. You don't have free speech rights to me. You don't get to come into my home and spew your nonsense. You'll get thrown right out and rolling and tumbling on the grass. Right. But to your government, you absolutely have the right to free speech, but you don't really have the... Maybe you've got the right to lie, but shouldn't we hold people or our debates to a little bit higher, a less ridiculous standard than just making stuff up for personal gain? It just seems like we're in this weird spot where, you know, everyone wants their minute of fame, and they're going to use free speech as the most ridiculous of ways.
Yeah, well, I mean, what really inspired me to write this column that we're talking about? It was watching J.D. Vance in that debate against Tim Walz last week. And what really struck me about the debate was the things that J.D. Vance was really fighting for. He was against fact checkers. He didn't want to be fact checked.
Yeah.
He was against experts when he was presented with, you know, what these Nobel Prize winning economists at the Wharton School said about how Trump's plan to blow up the deficit he didn't respond to their criticism. He just said, you know, who you, really you believe experts, you know, that they're making that up. So he's anti-experts. You know, when he was finally at the end confronted about his biggest lie, you know, this belief that Joe Biden didn't really win the election in 2020, he immediately changed the topic saying, you know, why was Kamala Harris trying to censor information about COVID on the internet? And what is he really, you know, I mean, all Vance did during the debate was he made these arguments that, you know, fact checking and journalism and all these other and science are all basically forms of censorship. That was one article. And the other half of the debate, he spent lying, whether it was about, immigrants in Springfield being here illegally, which they're not, or whether, you know, at one point he was going on about how we need more, you know, we need to burn more fuel because that'll help us reduce climate change, basically, was what I mean, just total nonsense. And but he's defending the right to say this. And it's like, you know, there's such a thing as having a right and there's such a thing as responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, there's a moral responsibility to try and seek the truth, whether you're a politician or anything else. And I mean, when they talk about the information on the internet about COVID, they're talking about telling people not to get the vaccine, which led to much higher death rates in Republican counties, or telling people you have the freedom not to wear masks, even when every public health official finally agreed that we should be wearing masks. You know, they're fighting for those freedoms, and they're fighting for the freedom to tell the big lie about Trump winning the 2020 election. And that's what motivates them. I mean, you know, it's a twofer really, because they get to make up these stories, but they also create this boogeyman that these pointy headed, you know, overeducated elites are out there censoring you. You know, the scientists are out to get you, all the journalists are out to get you, and this fact checking, you know, stuff is just part of their scheme to censor the truth that we are out there talking about, even when the truth is like utter BS. You know, yeah. the truth, you know, their truth is don't get vaccinated and climate change is a hoax. And these are the right to say this total nonsense is what they're fighting for. And they have the right. The Supreme Court in a 2012 case, actually, it's interesting, it was over the whole stolen valor issue, you know, and whether political candidates can lie about their military record and whether the government can make that a crime. And the Supreme Court said no. They basically confirmed, I mean, you have a right to lie. And I think, you know, I don't think the government should be arresting you if you want to post on Facebook about your belief that Bigfoot is real, you know, or that, you know, you think your neighbor was abducted by a UFO or something.
Yeah, but I think, you know, the rest of us should.
I mean, that's fine.
I think the rest of us should be looking at you with a jaundiced eye, going, "Seek help."
Yeah, but you know, I think we've always interpreted this in terms of individuals, right? If some guy wants to go down to the city park and stand on a soapbox,
I'm all in favor of it, and
talk about Bigfoot. That's we shouldn't be, we can let that guy speak or whatever, speak his mind. What the founders didn't have in mind when they wrote the First Amendment was that there would be an entire political party basically representing, you know, 45% of the American public, that would feel that it has a right to create total fiction and to try and run the country based on these made up stories, which is what they want to do. And if heaven forbid Trump and the Republicans win the election in November, they are going to run the country based on these fictions. You know, they are going to implement a mass deportation plan that would just cause utter chaos and be totally inhumane in addition to wrecking the economy. They will dismantle our entire program for fighting climate change, all to confirm their fictions that got them elected in the first place.
Now, what was the word that I've seen kicked around? Remigration. We're going to go around and pick up people who've immigrated here, and we're going to, through a remigration process, we're going to throw them out. Even people who have gone through the process of becoming
a citizen. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, Rick. I mean, once they get started, I mean, I mean, it's one thing to say, well, this person, you know, crossed the border and entered the country without documentation. Well, I mean, you know, they're supposed to get a hearing or whatever, but at least there's a process for that. But they're talking about going beyond that already. They're talking about stripping already granted legal status away from people like these Haitian migrants who come to this country. And, you know, I honestly think that once they cross that Rubicon, you know, once they, then anybody's going to be fair game. And if you listen to Trump at his rallies recently, he keeps, you know, anybody who's his enemy, whether it's, I'm not just talking about migrants. I'm talking about journalists or, you know, so-called rhino Republicans who've opposed him or whatever. He says he wants them to get out of the country. And so why wouldn't he start deporting, you know?
But, you know, the cover then, because you look at, you know, all of these claims, all of this conspiracy, all of this, you know, alternative reality, you know, while you're focused on that, you're not seeing the fact that, you know, J.D. Vance has done nothing for the state of Ohio to help the community of Springfield get the resources that they need to help meet the challenges of the community. No, we're not going to do that. We're going to imagine that people are eating dogs and cats. So to cover the fact that J.D. Vance didn't do anything to help his constituents.
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing story, and you probably know about this, about how the whole reason J.D. Vance got onto the Springfield story was because, you know, city officials, and I'm talking about Republican city officials in Springfield, wrote to Vance asking for his help with housing. They needed help from the federal government because, you know, with 5,000 or however many, you know, the numbers have been overinflated, but there are thousands of
Haitian arrivals
there, and it has put pressure on the housing market. I mean, that's called growth. I mean, that's any type of growing situation, you're going to have pressure on the housing market. And they asked the government for help. What can you do? And instead, Vance goes into a hearing the next day and is waving their letter and says, this is what's happening because of, you know, Biden and Harris's, you know, illegals, you know, whatever program. And he just decided to demagogue it from day one. And they're like that about everything. I mean, they don't want, you know, they don't want new factories that would build electric vehicles in their states. You know, they don't want clean energy, even though study after study has shown that, you know, making solar panels or wind turbines and whatnot are excellent sources of new jobs. You know, they're not interested in that. You know, I mean, you know, I wrote that whole book. I've been on your show a couple times to talk about the book that I published in 2022 about the college non-college divide. You know, people in these rural Republican districts are really suffering from a lack of access to higher education, and they want, you know, most families want that access, and their Republican elected officials don't care. They're not trying to make college more accessible or, heaven forbid, more affordable. They're trying to come up with ways to punish college and basically wreck higher education as we know it. And
not just higher education.
None of this is helping people.
No, you're right. And that's where I want to end this, because none of this stuff is about making people's lives better. You know, I want politicians who are going to use our government in a way to help us do the things collectively we can't do individually. I've been saying this for years. This is how we pave roads. This is how we educate a populace. It's how we get health care. It's how we protect the country. It's how we do a lot of things. And when you have one party hell-bent on destroying and tearing apart, there's a serious problem in the country. And look, as you pointed out, a large number of our citizens have bought into the hatred, the division, the things that tear us apart, instead of going having a common vision of what the future could be or what we should be doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, once you've bought into these alternative realities, it's very hard to break out of it. I mean, which is, you know, that's why you have people who become cult deprogrammers, right? Because people need to be deprogrammed. It is very much like a cult when you adopt.
Yeah. Any way out of this? Is there a way out of this?
I wrote about education because I believe in education, and unfortunately, that's a very long-term solution. I mean, we've let our education system, you know, not just higher ed, but K-12, the whole system. We've let our system slide, and I think giving people more access and more opportunity, you know, to learn and to grow would, and finding ways to expose people to people outside their communities or other types of people, which is something that education can provide also. Yeah. You know, I think giving people those opportunities, but that's not going to solve the problem in 2025. No. That could solve the problem in 2040, you know, but what are we going to do between now and then, right?
Well, and so, ultimately you can drag a horse to water, you can't make it drink. You can give people all of the information. If the red dye has, you know, has absorbed, yeah, in their head from the hats, I don't know where we go from here. But Will, as always, I appreciate the thought. Great work over there at the Philly Inquirer. You can check out his work. We'll get links out on social media. But Will, I appreciate the time, man.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Rick. I really appreciate coming on.
Thanks so much. Our good friend Will Bunch. I want to hear your thoughts. The disinformation machine, misinformation machine, is it touching your world? And do you see Trump actually running a campaign, or is David Corn right? Is this really just a misinformation campaign? Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break. When we come back, Jordan Barab is going to be here to share some thoughts on the deaths in Tennessee at a plastics factory, and maybe what we need to be doing in the future to protect workers. Back after this.
This is Oshkosh Air Support, WISS. This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly clear tonight, low 40s. Mostly sunny and warmer tomorrow, high up to the low 70s. Upper 70s for Friday, staying mild, but then cooler for the weekend. High in the mid-60s Saturday and mid-50s for Sunday. Right now it's 53.
From the lakeshore to Lake Winnebago.
Door to Fond du Lac counties.
Northeast Wisconsin is special for many different reasons. I'm Lisa Hale.
And I'm Terry Barr. Family and fun.
Save communities and friends. We're featuring all of it as part of New Wisco Weekend, a news magazine show just for you, and highlighting what makes the Fox Valley and Green Bay area a great place to live. Join us.
New Wisco Weekend, Saturday mornings at 8, Sundays at 11 on WGBW and WISS and the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the latest information I have on the tragedy on September 27th when Hurricane Helene went through North Carolina into Tennessee and all the damage that it did. Five workers are officially dead, one still missing at this Impact Plastics plant, where if you remember right from the very beginning on social media, you had some of the workers coming out and saying that the employer wouldn't let them go. They were afraid they were going to be fired. They were held, well, too long, and then it was too late. Now in the days since, the employer has come out and said, no, blame them. It's their fault. They didn't leave. An interesting scenario. So for me, the question is, well, going forward, what rules, what regulations, what laws should we be pursuing? Because interestingly enough, this Impact Plastics company has not reported those dead workers to the Tennessee OSHA and reported them dead. Now, I assume it's because if they report them killed on the job, they're going to have to take responsibility for it. That's what I think. But here to share some thoughts and get me some answers, I've asked my good friend Jordan Barab to come talk with us. Jordan was a former acting assistant secretary and deputy assistant secretary of labor for OSHA during the Obama years. My go-to safety guru. Jordan, thanks for taking time for us.
Glad to be here as usual, Rick.
So let's talk about this, the first part of it. The story is this company hasn't reported to the state that there were workers killed in their workplace. On the job, there are five officially dead now, one still missing. As of my last looking at this, and here, you know, we're 10 days away? Why not?
Yeah, well, you know, we don't have all the answers yet, but I mean, the workers say that they, by the time when they first wanted to leave, they were told by their supervisor that she would have to check with her boss to make sure that they were allowed to leave. Management says, yeah, they told them to leave right away. And for some reason, they dawdled in the parking lot until it was too late. The workers are saying you know, by the time we got out there, by the time they said we can go home, it was already too late. The parking lot was flooded, and you know, they took refuge in a pickup truck, which was eventually washed away. And you know, it's a real mess, and obviously, you know, is something that is avoidable.
Now, clearly, this is going to be a, you know, he said, she said scenario, of which I'm going to side with the workers, because I've heard these stories time and time again. You know, I think people are going to go, I want to get home to my family when things are flooding. Probably want to make sure my own stuff is secure. I doubt that they're just hanging around having a smoke after work.
Yeah, no, they had been told earlier to move their cars out of the parking lot, but they weren't told to, you know, to go home. And a lot of them were questioning, you know, why they were even at work that day. I mean, they knew there were, I mean, they didn't know quite how bad it was going to be, but they knew there were heavy rains coming. There were flash flood warnings. And, you know, why were they made to come to work? And then, of course, the second question is, why weren't they allowed to leave until it was too late?
Or the other part, and this is where I guess this is just my privilege speaking. Why would they even go in? You know, look, you know, when things are going to be bad, I make sure I take care of the home front first. I want to make sure my wife, my kids, my family's cared for, myself, job secondary. So the fact that they even went in on a day that reports were things were going to get bad, to me, that's the first problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, no, you're right, Rick. But, you know, you have the advantage of belonging to a strong union. You know, you have protections, but most workers in this country don't. So they're faced with something that's called job blackmail, your job or your life. You know, fine, you want to protect your family, you want to protect yourself, go ahead. But you're not going to have a job tomorrow when you come back. And you talk about caring for their family. I mean, these guys, you know, they're working there not because probably they love the job, but mainly because they need to put food on the table and care for their family. So being faced with, you know, losing your job or coming to work, you know, and without any kind of union protections, you know, they're unfortunately going to come to work and try to save their jobs and hope for the best.
Now, look, as someone who promotes unions and thinks that everyone should have a labor contract, this at-will employment scenario, I think is something that has to be addressed. And I say, look, you know, virtually every state in the country is an at-will state. There are some that have protection, but most don't. But if you have a labor union, you have a labor contract, that is, you can only be fired for just cause after a due process procedure. So for me, the question then becomes, shouldn't we be looking at getting rid of this at-will status? And you know, for everybody saying, you know, the only reason you can be fired is for an actual reason, not because I felt like it.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. And especially when you have an issue, you know, where it's again, your life is at risk. You know, that I mean, even unfortunately under the Occupational Safety and Health Act, the right to refuse hazardous work is a little shaky. It's not actually written into the act. It's kind of been interpreted that workers, you know, can refuse imminently dangerous work. But yeah, if you don't, you know, it's you know, it gets all mixed up in the definition of imminently dangerous and all kinds of stuff. So it's not real clear that workers even have the right to refuse dangerous work. You know, so it's the, you know, the law is very mixed, and you know, that's one angle we gotta look at.
No, because you're right. It is job blackmail. And look, if you go home, you're not going to come back, and you're not going to be able to feed your family. And oh, by the way, you know, we'll probably, you know, we'll harm your ability to get work in the future. And sadly, you know, this is where I'm not going to say this is the owner saying this stuff, but the frontline managers who have, you know, production goals, and they've got things pressing down on them.
Yeah.
I would argue that in many cases, a worker doing the right thing is in the best interest of the company as a whole, even if it's not making the frontline supervisors happy. And I've seen that play out in multiple mm-hmm. arenas where a worker did the right thing. The frontline guy wasn't happy, but it was the right thing, not just for the worker, but for the company as well, and saving them, you know, catastrophe down the road. And I think by having the ability to stay home or leave early, you would have saved this company a lot of public scrutiny right now.
Yeah, and save them a lot of their workers as well. I mean, you know, they got to come back from this.
So I guess the question that I have for you as the expert in this is, because I don't know if you've noticed, but these storms seem to be getting bigger. In fact, another one, you know, Milty right around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
What should we be doing? Because I went back and I looked at some of this stuff. This happens almost in all of these scenarios where, you know, something like this pops up. How do we prevent this going forward? How do we ensure that future wise to use maybe what we have, regulations we can put into place? I'm curious if you have any thoughts.
Well, that's, you know, that is a very good question, Rick. I mean, you know, to a certain extent, yeah, we've always had hurricanes, we've always had tornadoes, but clearly, you know, we have a lot more severe weather events recently due to climate change, and a lot more severe weather events. So, we see that, obviously, we see this almost every week now with, you know, hurricanes and tornadoes and floods and fires. It's kind of like regular news now. It's almost fallen off the headlines because it's so quote unquote normal. But you know, the regulatory environment has not caught up to that. There, you know, OSHA doesn't really have any regulations that deal with, you know, evacuations and things like that. There are some regulations that deal with fire exits and how you get out of a building and that type of thing. But there really isn't much there. And this is not the first time, you know, OSHA's had to deal with this. You know, a couple of years ago, you may remember there was a string of, you know, giant tornadoes that ripped through the Midwest and hit an Amazon warehouse in Indiana and another factory in Kentucky.
Right. The buildings collapsed.
And federal OSHA didn't really do anything it was in Illinois because it was federal OSHA jurisdiction. They didn't really figure they had any standards to really apply, and they didn't think they had enough evidence to deal with the general duty clause. Because, like, you know, I think between the two places, like 15 people were killed, and there was a lot of evidence of the Amazon, factory, the Amazon warehouse, that workers had, they didn't know there was an emergency response plan. They didn't know where to shelter in place. They didn't know what to do. In Kentucky, it was kind of the same thing, except the Kentucky OSHA actually did cite the employer there for about $40,000 because of a lack of any kind of emergency response plan. But again, those emergency response plan are mainly focused on fire exits and how to get out of the building. So I think it's clear that, you know, OSHA has to deal with, they're already starting to deal with climate change. I mean, as evidenced by their, for OSHA, fairly rapid work on a heat standard. And some states, especially in the West, now have standards that deal with wildfire smoke and, you know, workers that work outside. But, you know, OSHA's kind of behind, I mean, both in the federal and the state level, in terms of dealing with, you know, what we're seeing, you know, with climate change. And I think they're going to have to, they're going to have to deal with things like evacuations and how workers, you know, how employers need to respond, you know, to severe weather events, especially when they get notice from federal or state authorities that, you know, that workers need to evacuate.
Now, I go back to it. I know I'm going to get a lot of email from people going, well, you know, the workers should have just left. They should have taken it. They should have taken the initiative and taken it upon themselves, and they should have protected themselves, because this is what the right wing frame. This is what the employer's frame is. You know, ultimately, you made decisions. You had the freedom, the liberty. You could have protected yourself. How do we ensure that people who, when they want to protect themselves, aren't negatively affected by it? Like you said, aren't fired, are actually, you know, have some kind of rights in those scenarios.
This is your classic kind of blame the worker philosophy. You know, it's always the worker's fault.
It's not new.
Careless or, you know, whatever. So that, you know, that is to be expected in anything, not just this, but, you know, every time there's a trench collapse, you know, you ask, why did that worker go down the trench? Well, you know, I mean, maybe he knew it was dangerous and he feared for his job. Maybe he didn't know it was dangerous. And the employer said, oh, don't worry, it's safe. We do this all the time. You don't really know. Which is why you've got very strict, you know, OSHA standards and regulations that say what you can and what you cannot do. And that gives the workers, you know, the right basically to say, look, you're in violation of the law. And in some circumstances, actually to refuse to do it with the protection of OSHA. Because if you get disciplined or fired for refusing to work in certain situations, that is considered basically discrimination against the workers. And that's, you know, that's forbidden by the Occupational Safety and Health Act. But, you know, again, OSHA, you know, this is still relatively new, all of these wet, severe weather events. And, you know, OSHA just hasn't really had a chance to catch up with that. But I think, you know, whereas it takes OSHA, you know, it takes OSHA 5 to 10 to sometimes 20 years to issue a standard. I think, you know, they're going to need to start setting precedents by doing some citations under, you know, what's known as the General Duty Clause. General Duty Clause is what OSHA can use. General Duty Clause is paragraph 5A1 of the Occupational Safety and Health Act, and basically just says the employer is required to provide a safe workplace. And OSHA can cite employers using the General Duty Clause, even where there's no specific standard. Again, they didn't do that with that Amazon warehouse in Illinois, but I think this is something, you know, they're going to have to do, at very least, to put employers on alert that they do have a responsibility to protect their workers, even with you know, with these severe weather events.
Let me ask you about that, because, you know, my mind goes in, you know, the worker, you know, you pointed out about the trenches and some of the dangerous working conditions that employers should know their business better than their employees. So you never want to put your employees in danger or in a dangerous situation. You know, how much of that responsibility, you know, if you're looking at, you know, at the blame game, how much of it do you put on the employer for putting them in this situation? And how much of it is, do you think, the employees? I'm personally, just so we're open and on the same page, I'm not putting much responsibility on the worker, because you know, the employer has all the cards. They're the king of their kingdom. You go to work, you're at their will. They tell you where to be, where to go, what to do, when to do it, how to do it. That's part of the employer-employee relationship. So being part of that, I think that there's much, much more responsibility on the employer than the employee. But you, as the expert, I want to get your thought.
Well, I think you've laid it out exactly right. I mean, the kind of, you know, unfortunately, unequal power relationships in the workplace, and the workers always, especially if they're not in a union, but the workers always going to be on the losing side of that. But that's why the Occupational Safety and Health Act says very clearly that it is the employer's responsibility, not the employee's. It's the employer's responsibility to provide a safe workplace. You know, because they recognize the employer has total control over the workplace. The employer has total control over working conditions, and the employer has the ability to make a workplace safe. And that can either be done through OSHA standards, preferably, or through the general duty clause. But it's not just a matter of, you know, those of us who recognize, you know, the unfortunate power relationships in the workplace and how that's even worse when you don't have a union. It's the law of the land. The employer has a responsibility to provide a safe workplace, period, end.
Yeah. So last line of question I've got you for you, because we know that these storms are going to get worse, they're going to be more plentiful. More of this stuff is coming. We most certainly get that reality, that this is going to be something that goes on into the future and continues. What do you tell people? What do you tell individuals who are put in that scenario when they don't have a choice? You know, what? Given that, where do you tell people?
Well, you tell them that they ideally, you know, even if they are at risk of getting fired, it's probably better to be fired than it is to die in the workplace. But of course, everyone wants to, you know, be lucky and hope they don't, nothing happens to them. But otherwise, I mean, they are supposedly protected by the Occupational Safety and Health Act. My camera seems to have gone down for some reason.
It appears that, and this would be a good place to end. But Jordan, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much.
Okay.
You know, no, this is where my mind goes, and I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. This is why the pendulum, I think, is well to the side of employers being responsible, being, you know, the ones that we go get when bad things happen. Because they hold the cards. They have the power. And it would have been so much easier just to go, you know what? We're gonna send you home. We're gonna leave you at home. It just seems like it's so simple. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1997. That was the day that a group of female employees at the investment firm Smith Barney came to a tentative agreement to settle a sexual harassment lawsuit against the firm. Smith Barney was one of the oldest Wall Street firms, with a reputation for respectability. But behind closed doors, the firm more resembled what the Chicago Tribune described as a fraternity house atmosphere. The accounts women told of their treatment at the firm were lewd and disgusting. In the basement of the Garden City, New York office, there was a room called the Boom Boom Room, where female employees were told to entertain clients. Fed up with this treatment, more than 20 women joined together and filed a class action lawsuit. To settle the suit, the firm agreed to invest $15 million in diversity training, along with settlements to each of the harassed women. Sexual harassment of women in the financial industry was not only a problem. problem at Smith Barney. Female brokers in Chicago filed a suit against Merrill Lynch, who agreed to a settlement with the plaintiffs. Smith Barney also did not learn their lesson. Just over a decade later, the firm again settled another sexual harassment suit to the tune of $33 million. This time, according to Forbes magazine, the suit was filed by four female brokers who accused Smith Barney of preventing them from competing fairly for new accounts, promotions and pay, and depriving women of equal training and sales support. Over the course of 15 years, Merrill Lynch paid out almost $500 million in discrimination suits to women and minority brokers. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So look, you know, one of the things that I think really important that came out of that discussion with Jordan Barab is the fact that I believe that employers should be held to a much, much higher standard than what we hold them to. Because, you know, we've been trained to believe that, well, it's our job, you know, that we have some autonomy. That we have some bit of empowerment. Ask any worker who has a job if they think that they have some control. And everyone's going to say that they feel they have some autonomy. But when the rubber meets the road at the end of the day, as I said a moment ago, the employer has all of the power. They control in the workplace all of the levers, all of the they control the wages, the hours, the conditions, what work you do, when you do that work, how you do that work, all of those things. And you have the choice to just go home if you don't like it. And the reality is in the economy that we've been in most of my lifetime, most employees don't have that option. Most employees have the job they have because it's the best thing that they can get. Or it's, you know, the best thing around, and it's how they support their families. So an employer going, hey, if you leave, don't come back, because, well, we're an at-will employment state and you have really no rights. You have the right to file for unemployment, and you may get that. But unless an employer violates a federal law, you know, calls you old or says something about your race or your gender, or, you know, any of that, you've got no recourse. Just cause is a reason to fire you. And you have your recourse as well to file for unemployment. In this scenario, as we're looking at these storms getting bigger and more powerful and things, getting worse, you know, I do think that employers have to be held to a much higher standard and be held accountable for not just, you know, workplace fatalities, but injuries as well. And this idea that employers have a responsibility to care for their employees, a duty of care, if you will. The idea that employers have a legal and a moral obligation to provide a safe workplace, a safe environment, so people can come do their jobs, be as productive as possible, make the company as much money as possible, but also go home at the end of the day. And in the condition that they showed up to. And we need to hold employers accountable for that to ensure that that happens. We need to prevent negligence. You know, there are a lot of things that happen. Well, you know, it's not the employer's fault. You know, the employee did it. And yet they've known for years that this has been an issue. So we need to hold employers accountable to discourage negligence, bad supervision. And understand, you know, it's outside of just, you know, what should be legal. It's what should be right. Ensuring that your employees are treated well, that their well-being is cared for, that health and safety are paramount, so that your workers are happy and healthy and productive. That would probably lead to much higher profits. Kind of seems to be that virtuous cycle that we all want to get into. But sadly, for some employers, it's the low road. It's the threats. It's the intimidation. Well, if you leave, don't come back. That kind of stuff. And as I've been saying for a very long time, as a union guy, I don't understand that thinking. And, you know, real quick, I mean, you go back to the beginning when workers' compensation laws hadn't been put on the books. You're looking at right around the turn of the 20th century. You know, I think 1915 was the first, I think Wisconsin was one of the first states back then, 1912, to put workers' compensation laws on the books. Because what employers did is basically what this plastics company has done, and it's blamed the victim. You know, well, you know, it was their fault. You know, they were sitting on that flatbed. Blame the victim seems to work. Because even we as working people go, well, you know, I would have done something differently. Would you have? You know, I like to believe that I would, because I've been empowered my entire working life to say if something's wrong, I speak up to fix it. And that's why I thank my Teamsters Union for giving me that backing in the workplace. Everyone should have that. Without question, everyone should have that power to protect yourself, to protect your family, to protect your coworkers, to protect your company, to protect your community. It makes sense. Give you an example. Numerous times throughout my driving years, I have come across a vehicle that's had something wrong. Brakes out of alignment, the pads are worn too thin, the tread on the tires is too thin, the steering's out of alignment, whatever. Something's loose, something needs to be tightened, whatever. I am empowered to say, fix it. We're not moving it out onto that highway until that is fixed, until it's safe. Because not only am I protecting myself, I'm protecting the jobs of my coworkers, I'm protecting the company from potential lawsuits, and the community from a catastrophe that might possibly happen because of equipment that is faulty. And one company that I worked with used to have this 110-100 rule, that if you did something right the first time, it only cost a buck. If you didn't do it right the first time, and it got skipped over or had to do it again, it would cost $10. And the same thing, if you didn't do it at the second step or you did it wrong at the second step, by the time you got the third, it was $100, and so on. It went up. The longer the problem went without being addressed, the more costly it would be for the company, for the employees, for the community. Makes perfect sense. So for me, having people who are empowered to fix the situation right in the moment seems to be financially the smartest way to go about it. But sometimes, you know, companies don't think like that. You've got frontline supervisors who go, I've got quotas to meet. And push, not in the interest of the company, but in their interests of meeting their goals or, you know, whatever. So there have to be penalties in place to hold people accountable. And this is where transparency and reporting and regulations come in to ensure that workers have some bit of protection in the workplace from overbearing bosses. Look, I look at this plastic situation. Do I think that the company owner wanted this to happen? No, of course not. This is bad for them. This is bad messaging. It's bad for the company. It's harmful. It's all of that stuff. And for me, as a union guy, I go, you know, if there was a union at this plastic company and those workers were empowered to say, hey, maybe I'd like to go home. I don't care if the power's gone out yet. I'm going to go stay home and protect my family. Maybe we wouldn't be in this mess. So for me, having empowered workers protects the company from its own worst vices and is actually in the company's best interest. To have workers who do feel that they have some empowerment. They can report unsafe conditions without fear of retribution or retaliation or any of that. Maybe this is the message out of this is, how do we ensure that working people have the power to say, this is wrong? To have the ability to say, I'm going to do the right thing. Not the easy thing, not the expedient thing, not the thing that's going to make you the most profit, but the right thing. For me, that's the key. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. What do you think of all of this? Do you feel empowered in the workplace? Do you think you would do any differently than these workers? Do you think? I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast, freespeech.org, the website. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS 1100 AM Berlin, W252 DR Oshkosh, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.